I'm Carol Blue. I'm a professor at UNC Greensboro. My area is health promotion and health promoting behaviors. And I did this study, I'll tell you later, it was off of a grant. We have a center grant for health disparities. Lori Maddox was my research assistant on this study, and she is almost a doctoral candidate. She's getting ready to take her prelim exams at UNC Greensboro in exercise physiology. So she was perfect for me for being an RA on the study, since physical activity was one of my behaviors that I was wanting to have the participants increase. So, okay. I'm going to start out, and then Lori's going to do some of it about the study itself, and then I'll talk a little bit about goal attainment scaling. Okay, this research was funded through Deborah Wallace's Triad Center for Health Disparities grant, and I had the large study in the grant, which was called Efficacy of Motivational Interview to Lower Diabetes Risk in African Americans. This was a randomized controlled trial, and so I was blinded to all the data until just about a month ago, so I don't have all the data analyzed yet. Let you do this.
All right. To give everyone a little background, 25.8 million Americans have diabetes. Of these 25.8 million, 18.8 million people are diagnosed, and approximately 7 million are undiagnosed. And to add to that, 79 million Americans have prediabetes. Of these numbers, 12.6% are non-Hispanic, blacks, or African Americans. They also tend to have comorbidities and disease. And death-wise, diabetes contributed to 231,404 deaths, which is just a phenomenal number to me. Thank you. That's the number. That's the one I was thinking of. Also, for direct medical costs, this is thought to be $116 billion for just direct costs, and not even indirect costs. So this is a very big health problem. For my next slide, we have primary modifiable risk factors for type 2 diabetes. First is physical inactivity. It's not very hard to change the amount of physical activity that you have to increase health. And second, changing high-fat, high-carbohydrate diets to lower-fat, more unrefined carbohydrate diets, and changing the prevalence of overweight and obesity in populations. For the prevention or delay of diabetes, it has been well documented that weight loss, increases in physical activity, and changes to a healthy diet prevent or delay diabetes. And in the bottom, you can see the diabetes prevention program from 2006, which is published research and information from American Diabetes Association. So the purpose of our study was to compare the efficacy of three interventions in producing changes in physical activity, dietary behaviors, and physiologic markers of diabetes risk. So the individuals that we included in the study were African American or black adults ages 21 years and older that scored 10 or more points on the American Diabetes Association diabetes risk test. Who had a hemoglobin A1C of less than 7%. We made this number based on old hemoglobin A1C numbers, but right after we had gotten the grant, they had changed it to 6%. So I apologize for the the disconnect between current guidelines for hemoglobin A1C. Second was no physical or medical condition prescribing physical activity or low-fat, low-carbohydrate, high-fiber diets. And also, we had them go through the PAR-Q, the physical activity readiness questionnaire, to determine just in general if they were ready to start an exercise program. And the subjects had to be willing to wear a pedometer, which we provided for them along with replacement batteries so that they were able to keep readings continuously for the year they were in the study. So for our participants, the mean body mass index was 33.2 kilograms per meter squared, and the standard deviation 6.65. So it could have been a lot more variable. It could have been a little tighter. Our mean hemoglobin A1C was 6% for our population. Dietary fat, which we got from the, what is the name of that? Food frequency questionnaire?
Oh, it's the American Cancer Society food frequency questionnaire that we used. And then we had one of our statisticians just analyzed portions of that for us, and then we entered that data. So.
And so from the food frequency questionnaire, I don't know how I remember that, We saw that the mean dietary fat intake for our participants was about 109 grams of fat a day, or a little under 109. For fruit servings per week, about 4.28 servings. For vegetable servings per week, 5.08 servings. For carbohydrates per day, 361.86 grams a day. And then for total calories, 2,838.99. However, for the calorie number, I personally did a lot of the beginning and end interviews with our food frequency questionnaire. It tended to be hard. We had some individuals who didn't fill out the food frequency questionnaire themselves. So when you ask them questions, a lot of times I saw that they would choose the third answer, or if they got tired of you saying the certain answers, they would just pick one as opposed to fully thinking about what they had eaten, how much they had eaten, or they would think about food as far as, well, I cooked on Monday, even though I ate this food for 5 days or 3 days or 2 days, I cooked this meal on Monday, so this is the only thing I ate. And so that tended to be hard to try to tease out those differences in eating habits.
Okay.
For our experimental design, we had three groups. The first group received three different forms of contact between the study designer or researchers and themselves. They received the Small Steps, Big Rewards education packet, which is available online, and they had 7 sessions of motivational interviewing with counseling students who had been trained in goal attainment scaling, and then they worked with their goal attainment scaling to actually measure whether or not they had reached their goals. For our group two, they were our usual care group. They just received the initial Small Steps, Big Rewards education. And for our third group, they were our attention control group, and this is the group I worked the most with. They received the Small Steps, Big Rewards education, and then 7 extra sessions of health promotion education other than physical activity or diet. So I did presentations to them on cancer and what cancer actually was, how it developed, how it was treated, what it actually meant with staging for some participants, flu prevention, any health promotion items that did not have to do with physical activity or diet. And this was all completed over the course of 1 year. So they had, every 2 weeks, they had a session. My mind is getting fuzzy. It's amazing how that happens. Every 2 weeks for the first 2 months, once a month for the third and fourth month, and then a follow-up session in the ninth month.
Yeah.
So measures. We did a 7-day physical activity recall every 6 months for them that looked at the last 7 days of activity. And the diet history questionnaire was their food frequency questionnaire that we did at the beginning and the end of the study that looked where we looked at just fats, fruits, vegetables, and carbohydrates. However, we have data on much more than that. It was a very long questionnaire, and a lot of the participants did not enjoy that at all. We measured their BMI through weight measurement and height, and hemoglobin A1C with Bayer meters. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll turn over to Dr. Wood.
Okay, so the intervention group got motivational interviewing, which is a client-centered counseling style that emphasizes intrinsic motivation. So with motivation interviewing, you're supposed to get the client to see that the problem is theirs, that they own the problem, and so that they can come up with some ways that they can solve their own problem, and that builds up motivation intrinsically instead of extrinsically. So it's also a self-efficacy enhancing technique, so self-efficacy is a big part of motivational interviewing. We also have a recognition of the difference between their current behavior and their future behavior, and how that, in this case, would help them to eat a better diet, be more physically active, lose weight, any kinds of the activities that they could modify so to decrease their risk for diabetes, because that was their ultimate goal. Then we also help them in motivational interviewing to explore and resolve any ambivalence or reluctance to change. So any of you who have tried to change your own behavior, you can think of reasons why you can't modify your behavior, or you'll put it off until later. You know, this week is not good, but next week might be better. And so with motivational interviewing, we try to help people get over that ambivalence and really try make attempts to change their behavior. And then a commitment to change is what we work with them on. So part of the motivational interviewing, in motivational interviewing, we look at goals. So goal attainment scaling is not often a part of motivational interviewing, but yet we thought it would fit well with motivational interviewing as a formal way to set goals and try to meet individualized goals. So with goal attainment scaling, they have individualized change goals, and it allows comparison of goal achievement, because we actually put a score with their trying to reach a goal, or whether they are, you know, don't make the mark on that goal, they get a negative score for that. And so we can actually quantify the goal attainment that they are trying to achieve. There are steps in quantifying goal attainment. The first one is to identify the behavioral focus. So in this instance, the participant had to identify a physical activity goal and also a dietary goal for themselves that they were going to try to reach. And we don't have these ultimate goals. It can be a little goal, but it is the individual's goal, so everybody has a different goal. We translate the focus to three or more realistic specific goals, and then we give each goal a title, and the participant helped us do that. We choose indicators for each goal, We specify expected levels of outcomes for the goal, so what is the outcome that they want to do? We review level of outcomes for consistency, and then we specify somewhat more and somewhat less expected level of outcome for each goal. So the somewhat more becomes a plus one or a plus two, and the somewhat less would become a negative one or negative two. And that is what helps us make the scale for outcome attainment. And then we repeat these steps for each of the three or more goals. So our protocol for the goal attainment scaling was to decide on thematic areas to be scored. So we wanted a physical activity goal, we wanted a fruits and vegetable intake goal, and we wanted a fat intake goal. Most of our participants ate a lot of fat. When I did the dietary questionnaire with them, they would eat a lot of vegetables, and I'd think, whoa, that is really good that they're eating vegetables. But then when we got to the part about how do you fix your vegetables, it was a lot of fats in, you know, that made their vegetables tastier. And so that was a goal that many of them had set, was to decrease the fats in their vegetables. Then we constructed the individual indicators for each goal, and we constructed the expected level of outcomes for each goal, which was 0 points on a scale. That was the goal, and then, like I said, either plus one, plus two, or minus one, minus two. And then we identified the slightly better, much better, slightly poor, and much poor outcome for them. And then the motivational techniques were used to help the participants progress through these goals to reach their goals. Boy, that went fast. There is a goal attainment scaling score formula that one could use to evaluate the goals. However, I put the reference in for goal attainment scaling, this Karusik et al., and they have tables in the back of their book, so we just use the tables instead of using their formula to to determine what goals. But this formula has a weighting given to the goal, and then you use those level scores, which is the X to the I. So an example of goals, I haven't completed the analysis of all this goal attainment scaling yet, but I've given just some examples of it so you can see how it works. But for the diet, one person said they wanted to increase fruits and vegetable intake to 3 a day, drink 3 to 4 cups of water a day, and cut out soda to 1/2 liter, which to me seemed a lot, but this person drank 2 liters of soda every day, which is a lot of calories. And then exercise, they wanted to use the step counter every day, and Zumba every other day, and then activity. So this, when I put the numbers into a table, you can see how you could tell whether or not they reached their goal or did greater than their goal. So the pattern of GAS scores were positive toward the goal, and you could see that their pattern varied by the activity domain that they had. The intervention at week 6 did not appear to affect the goal attainment in the dietary domain, but if you looked at goals over time, you might be able to tell for future research when would be a good time to carry on the intervention. We needed to consider for progress toward a goal, which we can. So one more thing I wanted to say is, goal attainment scaling lacks validity and reliability. There are no studies that have been done on that. It's also been difficult for people to really set their goal because they had to think about what they wanted to do. And it was also very difficult to determine what would be better and much better or worse and much worse in that. So we wanted to provide education before setting goals, target behaviors that are very specific, and help participants provide realistic goals and to set more measurable goals.